decides what makes a language. In countries all over the world, there are official organizations with that job. In France, Croatia, India, Denmark, Nigeria, Mexico. But in the United States, there is no official language regulator. Here, the people decide our language.
In English, we don't have anybody telling us how to use it. It belongs to all of us. We can destroy it. We can reconstitute it. And if we all decide, as we did 20, 30 years ago, that the word bad was no longer simply mean not good, but bad could be cool or attractive, that's up to us.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today, immigrant writing that shapes the way we think about being and becoming American. Ilan Stavins embraces change in the English language. He sees it as a way to recognize what is great in America and to welcome newcomers. My Virginia Humanities colleague, Yahusuf Medina, spoke with Stavins about his book, The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language.
So, Ilan, I just wanted to introduce myself for a moment. My name is Yahusuf Medina, and I come from Afro-Puerto Rican parentage by way of New York City. But I also come to find that I have Sephardic Jewish ancestry as well. And so your work is of particular interest to me because several years back I came across your book, Travels Through Jewish Latin America. And it was inspiring. You know, it's refreshing to see that blend because the concept of there being Jewish Latinos is something that is somewhat of like a oxymoron in society and something that not too many people are aware of. So, you know, just I want to let you know I appreciate you for bringing that to the forefront.
I am thrilled. You know, when one sits down and writes, one imagines the different potential readers that might come one day, but it's really battling one's ghosts. And to hear that the book made an impression and that it is pushing you to see your own ancestry, Sephardic and Puerto Rican, in new directions, I couldn't be happier.
Yes, yes. To go into, you know, one of your latest publications, The People's Tongue. Mm-hmm. You know, in the beginning essay, you give this takeaway lesson that language belongs to those who use it. What do you mean by that?
Let me start by saying that I believe that language is who we are. It's the way we dress in front of others. It's the way we smile and hug and cry and move. Language is not only the vocabulary that we use to communicate. Language is the colors of the clothing that we're using today. It is the makeup. It is the gestures. We communicate with one another in all sorts of ways through all sorts of linguistic, verbal and nonverbal codes. And in particular, the code that is verbal attracts me enormously. I grew up in an environment where two or three languages interacting with one another, sometimes overstepping each other, stealing from Yiddish or from Spanish or from Hebrew. And so the purity of the language was never there. And when I came to the United States as an immigrant in 1985, I was absolutely struck, bamboozled, flabbergasted by the multiplicity of tongues that we use every day in this country. I was on a subway car in New York City, and within the ride from one station to another, you could hear Russian and Portuguese and Spanish and Yiddish and Swahili and Farsi, all kind of interacting, ignoring each other or, again, overstepping themselves. And to me, the main question then, and a question that has kind of propelled itself into the present, is how is it that the English language, the language that colonized us, the language from England, has become fully American by being nurtured by the many immigrant tongues that those that come to this country come with? And how is it that it doesn't break apart? How is it that it still functions? In the very idea of belonging, I will say that for me, sometimes it is easier to say that I was born into the Spanish language than the fact that I was born into Mexico, because the language, I carry the language with me and I continue playing with it, and I feel it was a cradle, it was a home. And I became a new arrival into English. And the question of who is the owner of English is very much front and center in me. Is it the native speakers that have had that language from day one for them? Is the language the property of immigrants and exiles and refugees and former slaves and tourists and many others? I think in the end, the language doesn't belong to the professors and to the highbrow intellectuals and educators. I think the English language is truly democratic and it belongs to all of us. We can destroy it, we can reconstitute it. And if we all decide, as we did 20, 30 years ago, that the word bad was no longer simply mean not good, but bad could be cool or attractive, that's up to us. Nobody can tell us not to do it if we do it collectively. Unlike other languages like French or Spanish, which have an authoritative and authoritarian academy that will legislate on how to use the language, in English, we don't have anybody telling us how to use it. It is the media, it is us, it is music, it is sports. And so if the language perishes, if the language gets all dirty, polluted, it is because of us. And if we polish it and if we make it shine, it is also as a result of our effort.
Something that I've been trying to work on is my proficiency in Spanish and also learning more Hebrew as well. But, you know, growing up, what we spoke in my neighborhood was Spanglish mostly. And so, you know, you have a number of pieces that you've written in or about Spanglish, probably the most well-known being Don Quixote. With you also being such an esteemed academic and Don Quixote being one of these monumental books that you know, no one is supposed to touch or what have you, what were people's reactions, I guess, in the academy? And then why translate it into Spanglish? What was your thinking behind that?
Well, first, let me tell you, I love Spanglish. I think Spanglish is cool, it's chill, it's eloquent, it's coherent, it's a language not only of the streets, but a language of knowledge, a language of music, it's a language of our roots, and Spanglish is also a language of the future. There are 60, 65 million Latinos in the United States. Many of us speak Spanish and or English, but many, many of us speak Spanglish. And there used to be a time when we were told Spanglish is broken, Spanglish is illegitimate, Spanglish is a prostituted language. That is nonsense. Spanglish is the birth of a new way of communication that results from people interacting with a new environment. It happened when Spanish was formed, that at the beginning it was a mix of Latin and the language of Castile. It happened with English in the Norman conquest. It happened with many other languages. So languages die, and we lament. For instance, in Latin America, there were many, many indigenous languages, and today there are very few because they have perished. But very seldom do we celebrate the emergence of a new language. And I think Spanglish is just that. And I think translation is a major part of any language. And I wanted to translate Don Quixote into Spanglish because I wanted to say that Latinos now also have their own version of Don Quixote. It's ours, the way at one point Don Quixote was translated into English or was translated into French or was translated into any other language. And as you might imagine, at the very beginning, when the first chapter came out, my God, the next day after the publication, I had thousands of emails, half of them saying that I was a heretic, that I should be ashamed of calling myself a teacher, a scholar, that I was doing a disservice to the next generation. And the other half was saying, thank you, we were waiting for this. You have opened up new vistas. I think that Spanglish, you know, there will come a time when there will be another translation of Don Quixote into Spanglish that will be done maybe 20 years into the future. That will be different. But that's what translation does. It gives you a snapshot, kind of a photograph of how language is being used at a particular moment in time and space.
You know, we've been speaking about the dynamics between Spanish and English, but there's also other immigrant populations, new languages that come to America, of course. And in The People's Tongue, there's a piece by Amy Tan where she talks about her mother's broken English. Can you tell us a little bit about that piece?
I love that piece. She talks at the beginning about the fact that her mother, the immigrant from China, could never become fully fluent in English, in that people were constantly referring to her as having a broken English. She reacts to that concept of brokenness in a very adamant and energetic way, saying there are really no broken languages. The languages, even when we don't master them, they are complete, they are wholesome, they are full. She, when she was young, as the little girl, would need to answer the phone because her mother was trying to communicate something with the doctor, but Amy had the fluency in English. And so the experience of seeing a parent struggle with the language, trying to desperately make it one's own, and at the same time kind of endowing the next generation to be the bridge, makes it a beautiful essay of the connection between the two. Eventually, Amy Tan would come to be one of the great American writers, and it is just moving to think that she sharpened her tongue, she polished her style, always with her mother in the background, speaking to her in that mix of Chinese and English that was essential to her upbringing. And she doesn't think, at least that's the way she presented in the essay, that because she can master the language is less broken or more wholesome. All languages have that cadence, that possibility. And one of the beauties of this country is that when you go to a public library, for instance, or to a restaurant or to a playground, you will hear different people using the language in different ways at their levels. And there is beauty to that work in progress because English is always being renewed, and it is the immigrants that work so hard, either themselves or their children, to learn the language and make a statement of arrival. English is now mine. I can communicate with others. I will not leave behind the Chinese or the Spanish or the Portuguese or the whatever background language you have, but English can be a neutral place with which we communicate with the rest.
You know, I wanted to also talk a little bit about your publishing company, Restless Books. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you, Restless? Why Restless Books? What is the understanding behind that?
Great question. To me, restlessness is a positive word that has to do with being curious, being engaged, going from one area to another in order to appreciate what we have around. I have the impression that this might simply be an image, but that we all have written in our foreheads the exact number of days that we're going to have. And every day that goes by, the number gets smaller. And it is a positive chronometer, a timer of, are you using your time in the right way, both for yourself, but especially for others? And when I started a publishing house, I wanted that restlessness. This is the 10th anniversary of Restless. It has published more than 150 books from 40 different countries and 35 different languages. Many of the authors are debut authors. That is, that it's the first book they publish in English translation or in English for the very first time. And I started it because I had benefited enormously from this country and from the welcome, openness, and encouragement of teachers and editors and friends who said, we want to hear what you say. And I reached a point when I was turning 50, when I realized that it was my time now to do the same that others had done. And what keeps Restless books going is that we really are presenting as broad, cosmopolitan, international, a diet or a menu of writers. And the purpose is very simple. In this country, America, that is the most powerful in the world, we sometimes can be very parochial, very isolated. It is important to read about other cultures beyond what we hear in the news, because news tend to package information in little snippets. And what we want is to understand people in full, wholesomely. And I think that that's what literature does. We can't live without telling stories. We ourselves are stories in motion all the time. We are narratives that are constantly being expanded and rearranged. And likewise, we depend on others telling us their stories constantly, in the form of a joke, a telephone conversation, a news piece. Stories are circulating all the time. You take away these stories, you take away the oxygen. That's what culture needs. Stories to live up and live with all the time. And I believe that in a country of immigrants, it is them, the immigrants, from whom we need to hear. What is it that brought them here? What were the challenges? We tend to think, oh, this is another immigrant story, but there are no two immigrant stories that are alike. Every immigrant is unique and different in their own way and will tell the story in an exclusive, delicate way. If the immigrant is 50, maybe that immigrant will see something that immigrant wouldn't have seen at age 20 or 40. It all depends on the moment we're telling it, and it depends on the audience.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much, and bendiciones.
Bendiciones. Muchas gracias.
That was Virginia Humanities Director of Community Initiatives, Yahousef Medina, in conversation with Ilan Stavins. Ilan Stavins is Professor of Humanities and Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College and publisher of Restless Books. His 2023 book is The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. In the U.S., Hispanic neighborhoods known as barrios blend American and Latin identities. Cristina Rodriguez is an English professor at Providence College. She says barrios play a big part in Latinx literature, but you've got to walk their streets to see how.
I've gone to each one of these communities and I've sort of walked their streets using a text as a map. Their works of fiction, their works of poetry, their works of memoir, but they are authors writing about their own hometowns. And they do so with such love and such detail that I can actually use a novel or a collection of poetry as my map, and I go to each of these spots. So to just give you some examples, El Monte is in East LA, and the greater city of El Monte tells a story of itself as this Western pioneer town, when in reality, of course, it had been settled by the Spaniards first, Native Americans before them, and it was built up by Mexican braceros. There were laborers who were brought over from Mexico to build the commuter rail, the trolley system that was connecting this community to Greater Los Angeles. And that labor camp grew into the El Monte Barrio. El Monte is still today, it's majority Chicano, Chicana, and Mexican. It's dominated by this kind of rescuache aesthetic, which is this idea of making do with what you've got, with sort of materials on hand, brightly colored lawn decor and altars to the Virgin Mary and Christmas lights all year round. It is very much a world unto itself. And you can see that in the novel about El Monte that Salvador Plasencia writes.
And tell me about the novel and the author.
Yeah, Salvador Plasencia wrote this great debut novel. It's called The People of Paper in 2005. He's first generation Mexican-American. He moves to El Monte from Guadalajara when he's a teenager. And the book is wild. It's got inserted images. It's got multiple columns of text. It's got there's a war on the narrator. It's bananas. It's got all kinds. It's got graffiti. And people have tried to figure out what that is. Is it surrealism? Is it metafiction? And what I found walking the streets of El Monte was that aesthetic was there. The kind of cluttered, the delighting and sort of putting together, juxtaposing all kinds of different materials, the insularity, the Mexican influence, all those things were there. It wasn't a surreal depiction at all. It was actually very realistic if you've walked those streets.
You also went to the great Washington Heights neighborhood in New York City. Tell me about what that was like and whose text you were using to identify places and styles.
Yeah, I went to, yes, Washington Heights, Quisqueya Heights, as it's known. It's the heart of the Dominican diaspora in the United States. I was tracking Angie Cruz's debut novel, Soledad, which came out in 2001. And that novel, the narrative is totally chaotic. There are multiple voices. The text is super crowded. There's all this surveillance. Everyone is watching each other. It's noisy. It's claustrophobic. You know, and I went to Washington Heights, and I stayed in the neighborhood for several days. And walking 164th Street, where most of the novel takes place, and the environs, I honestly felt like Angie Cruz downplayed it. The claustrophobia, particularly for a woman on the street, and the predominance of the male gaze in the neighborhood. I write about this in the book, but walking down Broadway on a weekend morning, there were older Dominican men who would just line up their lawn chairs facing out onto the sidewalk, just to comment on the women walking by, just to, you know, make known their thoughts on what you were wearing or how much you were smiling. And the intensity of that surveillance really became clear to me as a result of going to that neighborhood.
These writers who are writing about the barrios they grew up in or have lived in or know so well, are they affectionate toward the barrios, clear-eyed, hostile?
It's a great question. What I found was that these authors who are first and second generation Latinx authors, right? So they're in between countries in many ways, that they anchor themselves in their neighborhood and they anchor their identity in being experts in their neighborhood. So kind of in the midst of feeling uncertainty about who they are, how they fit into the United States, they double down on where they're from, that's the identity that they can claim. So there is a lot of love, I think. You see the love in these texts, even fictional texts, even wildly surreal texts, experimental texts. The place detail is accurate. It is real life accurate. And that to me speaks to love, that these authors want to get it right. They want to demonstrate their sort of authenticity and their connection to place. So I think it is trying to give us this place that has made the author who he or she is.
You also went to Parlin, New Jersey, where Juno Diaz grew up. What did you learn about Juno Diaz by going to Parlin, New Jersey?
A big thing I learned, almost all of Juno Diaz's work is his protagonist is Junior, who's this kind of alter ego. So in his first collection, Drown, and also in This Is How You Lose Her, he refers often to this dump, a garbage dump at the edge of his housing project. And you might read that and think, okay, I guess it's a metaphor, you know, it's just, and
yeah,
this dump was active during Juno Diaz's adolescence. It has since, it shut down improperly. It is still a toxic waste site. And it's right there at the edge of the neighborhood. It's not a metaphor. It's not subtle. It is a very real environmental threat to that community. And the toxicity of it, that toxicity lives on. And it's almost too perfect a metaphor for the kind of toxic masculinity of the Dominican American community that Diaz grows up in and is battling in his texts.
Do you think all these writers are writing more to people in their own communities, or are they trying to translate these neighborhoods and their homes to audiences who don't know them?
I think it's both. As I mentioned before, the authenticity, the real life accuracy of the place detail, that to me speaks to an audience of folks who might be from the same community, wanting to get it right. But I think also by capturing the barrio on the page, they are trying to desegregate it, right? Take it out of this insular position it occupies in the United States and bring it into the mainstream and get their beloved hometown out there. And I think that there is this desire or this urgency to capture the place, so to protect it, to preserve it, and to share it.
Well, what a cool idea for a book, really wonderful book, Walk the Barrio. Cristina Rodriguez, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
Cristina Rodriguez is an English professor at Providence College. Her book, published by UVA Press, is Walk the Barrio, the Streets of 21st Century Transnational Latinx Literature. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason. At the turn of the 20th century, immigration to America was booming, and immigrant writing about the making of an American was wildly popular. Christina Stuntschuh's new book, The Makings and Unmakings of Americans, argues that it's worth looking at those works alongside another group, Native Americans, who were also trying to prove their case as Americans in the public sphere. Christina Stuntschuh is an English professor at Virginia Commonwealth University and the director of the Humanities Research Center there. Christina, your new book, The Makings and Unmakings of Americans, looks at the late 19th and early 20th century. What did American immigration look like at that time? Who was coming here?
Oh, the immigration landscape of the 19th century was wild. I want us to picture new immigrants coming into the country in 1883. This is exactly 1 year after the Chinese Exclusion Act, which excludes immigration from China, from most Asian countries, and there is still a need for labor in the United States. So who is going to perform that labor? Well, the door to Eastern and Southeastern European immigration is open. In 1892, Ellis Island opens, and millions of immigrants start coming into the United States. Polish immigrants, Croatian, Slovakian, Romanian, Russian immigrants or from the Russian Empire, the Slavs, right? And there was this animosity toward new immigrants that we hadn't really seen before in the United States. This animosity came primarily from how different they looked, they sounded, their unwillingness to assimilate in many cases. And so between the 1880s and the 1920s, we see an emerging discourse of restriction.
What did immigrant writing look like during this time? Were people writing books, memoirs, newspaper articles?
Immigrant writing in the foreign language press, which is one of the archives I'm really passionate about, shows us that by the 1920s, the United States had 140 daily foreign language newspapers, right, in immigrant languages circulating throughout the United States with the purpose of teaching immigrants how to acculturate, how to become American, but also including occasionally pieces of literature. First of all, there was the sort of required immigrant genre, which was the autobiography. And I highly recommend this book from 1917, this memoir called An American in the Making, which really tells a story of self-making.
Who wrote this memoir, An American in the Making? And what was the writer saying about becoming an American?
So Marcus Eli Revidge wrote An American in the Making, The Life Story of an Immigrant, in 1917. The story became so popular in the New York City schools, it almost became the manual of Americanization for new immigrants in New York City. And what readers at the time did not realize was that it was actually very critical of Americanization. And it really advocated for not just immigrant labor, but he introduces something very unique, which is intellectual labor and becoming an immigrant writer, right, in the United States, or becoming an American through writing. In the same year, 1917, The Rise of David Levinsky by Abraham Kahan was also published. Kahan was, you know, really became the so-called father of Jewish American literature. He was from Lithuania. And in the United States, he became the person who wrote and welcomed so many immigrants, Jewish immigrants in particular, to the United States. He founded the Jewish Daily Forward, or the Vorwärts, in the 1890s, if I'm not mistaken, where he gave advice to new immigrants on how to become American. He also published literature, so he tried with his publication to socialize new immigrants into, you know, these new genres.
You say he told other immigrants how to become an American. How did he say you become an American?
He published a column called A Bintel Brief in the Jewish Daily Forward, which was an advice column to immigrants. The advice column included everything from, you know, drawing your first papers as an immigrant to accessing the public library, how to go to the market, right? All these mundane experiences that were part of, you know, immigrants' daily lives were addressed. How to go to the post office, how to do this, right? So I found some immigrant diaries in the National Archives with similar stories, right?
Yes.
Diaries detailing, you know, the daily life of immigrants from their own perspective, right? What they did, how the wife went to the market, what the immigrant wife felt about not being able to naturalize, right? Her husband could naturalize, but she could not. And all these thoughts and feelings about becoming an American that many immigrant writers expressed in their own languages that we are just now beginning to discover because they either haven't been translated yet or we haven't really incorporated this corpus into our study. One of the foremost historians of immigration, his name is John Heim, said that serious American literature almost totally ignored the immigrant. And I think that's true. I think up until, you know, Ravage and Kahan, there's very little interest in the immigrant story from an immigrant perspective.
How did they push back against this dismissal by the prominent writers of new immigrants to the U.S.?
They pushed back in various ways. I think in some ways by inhabiting the same spaces that the, you know, writers like Stein and Henry James were inhabiting. For example, Marcus Eli Ravage published An American in the Making, serialized at first, and he published it in Harper's Magazine, which is a literary journal with wide access throughout the United States. And so they used literary newspapers or literary magazines with wide distribution to appeal to the readership and to present in small, these are small doses, right? To expose readers bit by bit to a different story of immigration told by an immigrant.
You write that Native American writing during the same period was doing many of the same things that new immigrant writing was. People were writing memoirs, autobiographies, sort of staking their place in the American mainstream.
Absolutely. Both the story of immigration, particularly of new immigration, and, you know, the restriction of immigration in 1924, and the story of indigenous dispossession and then enfranchisement in 1924 are essential to the story of America. And I'm glad we're doing this interview in 2024 because we have 100 years of distance to think about these things. So let's consider these two things. In May, late May 1924, Calvin Coolidge signs into law the Immigration Act. It introduces the quota system based on national origins and restricting the numbers of Eastern and Southeastern European immigrants. This act also excluded immigrants from East and South Asia, but that's another discussion. So this is it, May 1924. 1 week later, the same president, Calvin Coolidge, signs into law the Snyder Act, which is also the Indian Citizenship Act, granting universal citizenship to Native Americans. So on the one hand, we see exclusion of immigration, right? On the other, a week later, the culmination of work toward enfranchising indigenous people after centuries of dispossession and genocide. Why this convergence, if you will? Why then?
And why do you think?
The indigenous population in 1924 was at its lowest in history, right? On the other hand, the immigrant population had simply exploded. So It was threatening the American sense of whiteness, right? A racial sense of superiority. And it was turning the nation into something that I think it wasn't prepared to address. Turning to indigenous people, the first Americans, right, glorified in public discourses as the first Americans, was easy. It didn't really cost anything. So I think it was, you know, to put it very simply, it was a good moment to frame this Indian citizenship as inclusion, although, quite honestly, this didn't really do much for indigenous communities.
Christina, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
My pleasure, Sarah.
Christina Stunchu is an English professor at Virginia Commonwealth University and the director of the Humanities Research Center there. Her book is The Makings and Unmakings of Americans, Indians and Immigrants in American Literature and Culture, 1879 to 1924. There's a certain expectation from both publishers and readers about what an immigrant story should sound like. Some kind of trauma followed by hardship and migration, And then the main character comes out on top. But my next guest says that immigrant writers are constantly resisting and countering that expected story. Katrina Powell is a professor of writing at Virginia Tech and founding director of the Center for Refugee, Migrant, and Displacement Studies there. Katie, you talk about a particular story that immigrant writers are often expected to be telling. What is that story?
Well, I think there's very much an expectation of what an immigration or refugee story is. And there's often a particular kind of narrative arc of someone overcoming adversity, moving to someplace else in order to either find safety, security, or economic opportunity. And then once they arrive in that place, then everything is much better, and they're grateful for everyone's help getting there, and that the reading audience can then learn from that story. And that sort of narrative arc is expected, especially the part about a migrant or a refugee being grateful for the opportunity.
What do you mean expected? Are we readers expecting it, or are book publishers expecting it?
Both. We do as readers sort of have this expectation there, and there are some repeating themes that come in a migration narrative. There's usually a longing for home, even if that home was violent. There's very much a connection between land, language, and identity, and people often write about missing the landscape and describing the landscape of their home country. The experience of having to learn a new language once they get to a new place and what that means for them in terms of their identity. And also, there's an expectation that one would describe the trauma and violence they've been through. There's often a sense of abandonment of some sort, either being abandoned by one's country or one's family or the rest of the international community. And so those themes often arrive in a migration narrative.
What do you find are some of your favorite books or writers who are resisting that expected migration or immigration story?
Yeah, so what I'm really interested in my own work are the narratives that resist those typical themes and resist that typical narrative arc of overcoming adversity and being grateful and living happily ever after. I'm really interested in the narratives that expose different kinds of inequities, both in the journey of displacement or forced relocation, but also in the moment of resettlement. And so I have a few favorites that I like to teach my students. One is a collaborative effort between the novelist Dave Eggers and a lost boy from Sudan named Valentino Achak Deng. And the name of the novel is What is the What? And it's really interesting that it's called a novel. It's based on Valentino's oral history. It writes about how a refugee's story does not end once they resettle in the United States. Valentino experienced a lot of difficulty when he resettled here in the United States, and he writes about that. He also writes about how the United Nations, in selecting him to be in the refugee resettlement program, expects them to tell their story of trauma. One doesn't necessarily qualify to become a refugee unless they have experienced trauma and violence and they fear persecution. That's the legal definition of a refugee. And so they're required to tell their story. What does it mean that someone is required to tell their story, their personal and intimate details of violence and trauma, so that then they can obtain some resources and get into the refugee resettlement program? Some other favorites I have, for example, are Gloria Anzaldúa's Borderlands, where she talks a lot about the very contested Mexico-U.S. border and how that border came about and what it means to live at the border, both in terms of the landscape and the land, but also in terms of language. And I love the way she weaves Spanish and English together without necessarily translating, and that resists the expectation that everything has to be in English or that English is the one language. And so I appreciate that kind of resistance as well. And a lot of the narratives that I study and that I'm interested in are very much interested in representing a story or a self that resists the idea that trauma is the only thing that defines them. Often, audiences read those narratives as something experienced out there. And with climate change, with increasing unrest across the world, displacement is increasingly a common experience. And so the narratives that I like to read are the ones that talk about the messiness of identity. They expose inequities in refugee camps and detention centers. They expose local, federal, and international laws that often create barriers for one's resettlement journey. And so in that way, they are resisting that the migration story is an individual's story. The migration story is not a universal story because everyone's story is different. But what migration stories point out to us is that systems put in place, either whether they are laws or procedures for resettlement, are often inequitable and people experience them differently depending on their situation.
There's another sort of book you also include in your teaching, and this is one called Among the White Moon Faces. Mm-hmm. And it's a memoir by someone who migrated to the U.S. to get her education, as yes. opposed to having a traumatic home experience.
Yes, Shirley Gicklin Lim wrote the book Among the White Moon Faces, a memoir, and she's a poet and a novelist and has published lots of things. But the memoir is really interesting because part of what she tells us is the history of China and Malaysia, how she was sent to a private Catholic school where she learned English. And because of her own home situation of being forced to learn Chinese and not speak Malaysian, English became a place of refuge for her, where she learned to write poetry in English. But she does come to the United States then to earn her PhD. And her stories of adjusting to life in the United States, she talks about the way her body moves through a very white space. So she has roommates who are white, and she talks about her interactions with them. Her professors are all white. She teaches students who are all white. And then she goes to New York and teaches in the Bronx, where she's teaching more Latino group of students, and just talks about the experiences that they have that are similar, but also that are different, and what it means to be a migrant in this country, just learning about how to move, how her body moves among other people in the country.
You touched on this a minute ago, but you've also talked about how people who've migrated here are kind of expected to educate white American audiences in various ways. What do you mean by that?
I think there's a sense by publishers that white audiences are interested in reading about trauma. And I think there's a number of reasons for this. Some of it is good with good intentions, trying to learn about a situation in another place. And some of it, though, is sort of a voyeur way of looking at someone else's life. Some of what that does is distance audiences from those experiences. And so if one is inexperienced in issues of trauma or issues of race or issues of migration, if you ask one person to be the representative of that whole group of people and educate you about those issues, that's a lot to put on someone else. And so there's this constant tension. It's a necessary tension, but there's a constant tension between anyone who wants to learn about what's happening in the world, whether it's issues of civil unrest or whether it's an experience of having been displaced and losing one's home due to a hurricane. There's this sense of wanting to learn, but there's also the great burden that we put on people to be the speaker for an entire group of people. And so when I study these narratives with my students, we talk a lot about that, about what it means to want to publish one's story, who benefits from it, why does one tell their story, and what might be the kinds of consequences that would come from publishing that story.
I wonder, when you talk about how writers have resisted the expectations of the immigrant or migrant story, do you have any suggestions for how readers and also writers can subvert or resist the expectation?
Yes, I think one way is by telling one's full story, using what we call a birth-to-present approach. I think someone telling their story, including where they grew up, who they were as a child, what their hopes and dreams were and are, and how they lived, what their house looked like, what their garden looked like, in addition to the story of their forced relocation, gives a better sense of the whole person rather than reducing them to only their trauma or only their migration status. And so I would suggest if anyone is interested in writing their own story, to write their relocation or their displacement experience in context of the entirety of their whole life, because it is just one moment in their life and it doesn't define them entirely as a person.
Katie Powell, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Katrina Powell is founding director of the Center for Refugee, Migrant, and Displacement Studies and a professor of writing at Virginia Tech. Her forthcoming book is Beginning Again, Stories of Movement and Migration in Appalachia, published by Haymarket Books through a fellowship with Voice of Witness. This program is made possible by funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the United We Stand Connecting Through Culture Initiative. Support for this episode of With Good Reason comes from the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. This is a charitable trust created by the will of acclaimed 20th century artist Joseph Cornell that honors the memory of the artist and his younger brother Robert. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. The With Good Reason production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening. Thank you.